This is WSHU's After All Things with daily news and culture from around Long Island Sound. Coming up, we're talking all about America 250. Local history and more is coming your way. I'm Sabrina Garone. There's only one known intersection in America where the buildings at all four corners were built before the American Revolution. The place is Kingston, New York, the state's first capital until British troops burned it to the ground. But that corner survived, and a few dozen more structures thanks to some hefty building materials. WSHU's Davis Donovan visits for the series Off the Path.
New York State chose Kingston as its capital in 1777. At that time, New York City was occupied by the British during the war.
They read the New York State Constitution aloud for the first time right on the steps here in Kingston.
Historian Taylor Bruck.
It was really the central location for New York State's new government, which, don't forget, at the time, is a treasonous act. Everything that's going on here in that period is treasonous.
The British marched into town.
They walked through the town with torches, throwing them at the roofs. Everyone had already fled. They essentially burned an abandoned town. And they went house to house, just burning every single one.
Years later, the townspeople returned to rebuild. They had one big advantage. Many of the city's buildings were made of sturdy gray stone.
A lot of the wood was destroyed, but a lot of the stone still stood. So even after they were just ruins, when folks came back, they rebuilt the roofs and they started using them again. And it's part of the reason they're all still here today.
One of the four stone buildings at this intersection was the Kingston Academy, founded in 1774.
So this was one of the first public schools in New York history, the only school in almost a 50, 60 mile radius.
Two of the houses are private residences, still named after their colonial owners. The last of the four houses on the intersection is the oldest.
Now we use it as a museum, and every May through October, we open it up to the public.
Its first owner was a 17th century Dutch surgeon. It ended up in the hands of a man named Matthew Person, still the house's namesake.
When he takes over, he turns it into an inn. And so it's a tavern, it's a public house. And we like to imagine, you know, all the folks that are writing the New York State Constitution right across the street, likely at the end of the day, coming across the street here to Person House to drink and whisper about revolution and whatnot. Let's go ahead and open the door here.
Taylor leads me inside.
So we're actually we're inside the house, now walking through the original exterior of the Person family's house.
And these stone walls are just incredible.
We walk around the grounds a bit. Most of that former farm is now a parking lot, but we notice a lot of people taking pictures in front of a blue state historical marker on the corner. It reads,
"The Four Corners, all four stone houses at this intersection built between 1663 and 1775 prior to the Revolutionary War."
One person after another gets their picture in front of the sign. They're all fascinated. One woman keeps sending over her friends to look at it.
I love telling everyone who has never been to Kingston about it because it is such a fun fact.
That's Grace Moore, who's hosting a birthday party at the bookstore across the street.
I'm an instructor at the Kingston Ceramic Studio, so I'm here with a bunch of my coworkers from the studio.
For historian Taylor Bruck, these four corners are a reminder that freedom is worth fighting for.
People risked it all for that opportunity and for the rights that we have, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Like, they were taking their lives into their hands to try to build a better future, not just for Kingston, but for the whole country. And I think that's something that Kingston has leaned into, and that's why we like public art and we like to be creative.
And maybe feel a kinship with the Kingston residents who brought this town back from ruin more than 200 years ago. This is Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio. I'm Davis Donovan.
Coming up, it's the series finale of WSHU's The Making of Us, and we're taking it back to 1776. Stay here. Connecticut lawmakers marked the country's 250th birthday with a reading of the Declaration of Independence at the Old State House today. WSHU's Molly Ingram reports on some of the state's ties to the document.
As one of the oldest states in the Union, Connecticut has deep ties to the Revolution. Roger Sherman, who lived much of his life in CT, is the only person to have signed all four of the country's major founding documents. He helped to write the Declaration. And former Governor John Trumbull was the only one of the 13 colonial governors to support the Revolution. Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz read the first few lines of the Constitution.
"We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
Connecticut's official nickname is the Constitution State, but it's not because of the U.S. Constitution. The state adopted its fundamental orders in 1638. It was among the first ever written constitutions to give power to the people. Molly Ingram, WSHU News.
Public safety officials advise residents to be aware of firework safety protocols this 4th of July weekend. WSHU's Janice Roman has more.
Senator Richard Blumenthal met with fire officials to warn people about fireworks. Fire officials say fireworks are illegal for residents to use unless they are sparklers or fountains, which are ground-based fireworks. Blumenthal says last year, 15 people in the U.S. died from fireworks and 13,000 were injured.
Holidays can turn tragic if people fail to exercise caution and care. If it explodes and burns, it is a potential killer.
Malfunctions and misfires are one of the most common causes of injuries. Fire officials advise to keep children away from explosives and to have water nearby if setting off fireworks. Janice Roman, WSHU News.
Two Massachusetts-based biotechs are teaming up to resurrect the American chestnut. The tree species has been virtually wiped out in the U.S. by disease. The New England News Collaborative's Fausto Menard has more on the effort.
Years ago, Lincoln-based Silva Bio developed what it says is a blight-tolerant American chestnut. CEO Michael Bloom calls that the first major breakthrough.
But the biggest challenge today isn't whether the science can work, it's scaling production so restoration can happen across millions of acres.
That's where Cambridge-based Foray Bioscience comes in. CEO Ashley Beckwith says traditional seed production by Mother Nature is very slow and can produce widely varying results in terms of blight resistance.
We're able to create seeds from cells instead of having to wait for a full tree to mature and produce seeds and test those seeds on their own.
In time, the two companies hope to plant tens of millions of chestnuts and other tree species across the U.S. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fausto Menard.
This is WSHU's Bird Song Break. This week, of course, our national bird, the bald eagle. Practically non-existent in the lower 48 just a few decades ago, their numbers are now soaring. Connecticut supports an estimated 100 nesting pairs, and there are an estimated 8 to 12 nests on Long Island. You'll see more of them during the winter months, but some are here all year round. Take a breath, listen, and let nature remind you to slow down. This has been WSHU's Bird Song Break, featuring the bald eagle as we celebrate America 250 this weekend. Special thanks to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The big day is almost here, and for the final episode of WSHU's The Making of Us, Molly Ingram goes back in time to the start of the American Revolution.
In the years leading up to the American Revolution, an estimated 2.5 million people lived in the 13 colonies, the U.S. Census estimates. Around half of them are thought to have been enslaved people. It's hard to know exactly how many people there were because the first census count wasn't taken until the 1790s. But the vision you may have of those colonists, displeased with their life under Britain's rule and desperate to break free, isn't necessarily true. Matthew Skick is the director of collections and exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia.
Many of these Americans, whether they're in Massachusetts or Virginia or New Jersey, are very proud to be part of the British Empire. They're particularly happy to be part of what is known as the British Constitution, the system of government that is governing the British Empire.
They're particularly happy with the fact that each colony has its own legislature, made up of mostly property-owning men. However, that contentment changes, and fast. In 1665, Great Britain began looking for ways to raise money, which they needed to defend the territory they had just acquired in the French and Indian War.
These are Native American lands that are being administered now by the British Empire. And there's conflicts between Native nations and the British that break out, particularly in response to colonial settlers moving into those lands and trying to move into those lands.
Parliament came up with the Stamp Act, a tax on all paper goods. It was the first direct tax levied on the colonies, and they weren't happy. The saying, no taxation without representation, comes from the Stamp Act. It's a major turning point.
This is not taxation that was decided upon by the colonial legislatures in each of those colonies. And so that creates a moment of tension, deep tension, that is questioning what is the relationship between the American colonies and the British government.
Next comes taxes on tea, paint, and more. By the end of 1768, British troops were stationed in Boston to enforce the taxes. One clash between the soldiers and colonists left 5 people dead. It's called the Boston Massacre. But still, despite their frustration, colonists weren't immediately ready to fight for independence.
In 1775, when the war breaks out, many Americans are joining this fight against the British army, not yet to separate from Britain, but to restore their rights and liberties within the British Empire.
Again, that changes quickly. Shortly after the war breaks out, King George III declares the colonies in open and avowed rebellion, and colonists take that as him turning his back on them. And British leaders stationed in the colonies offer enslaved colonists freedom in exchange for fighting on behalf of Britain. In January 1776, Thomas Paine published his pamphlet called Common Sense.
That puts in plain language the idea that the United Colonies should break away from Britain, create republics using republican forms of government, and create a new nation to wage war and fight for its independence from Great Britain.
And on July 4th, 1776, 250 years ago this summer, the Second Continental Congress adopted the final text of the Declaration of Independence. It was signed in August. It's a celebratory day for many of the colonists. However, there's still a long way to go. A misconception about the Revolutionary War is that the Continental Army, which represented the colonies, was a ragtag volunteer army. Well, one of those things was true. They were ragtag, but they were professionally drilled.
The army was often ill-equipped and ill-supplied. They sometimes struggled to provide enough food for their soldiers, enough pay for their soldiers, and pay using money that actually had value was a struggle. Uniforming the soldiers was often difficult.
The Continental Army lost a series of battles in New York and then in Philadelphia. Brutally cold winters further hurt morale. Throughout the war, women, Black, and Native Americans play a major role on both sides.
There are thousands of Black soldiers that serve in George Washington's army. It's very much an integrated army. Women are actively involved in the army as well, for the majority as camp followers.
For many Native Americans, an independent United States that was likely to expand further west was more dangerous than British-controlled colonies, so they sided with the Crown. The war changes tides when France joins in support of the colonies after a major win at Saratoga. At the same time, the British are also up against the Netherlands and Spain.
Now the British are having to fight not only in North America, but in the Caribbean, the Atlantic, off the coast of Africa, the Mediterranean, trying to defend Britain and Ireland itself, but also battles waging with the French and the Dutch in off the coast of the of India and Southeast Asia. This is a war that is increasingly difficult for the British to maintain
Washington's tactic was to keep troops on the field at all times, in as many places as possible. In the fall of 1781, the British troops surrendered after the Battle of Yorktown. Still, New York and North Carolina remain in British hands until the Treaty of Paris is signed to officially end the war 2 years later. The treaty is signed without any input from Native Americans.
Its lasting effect is dramatic population shifts of thousands, tens of thousands of people who are forced to leave the United States and resettle elsewhere. That's Native Americans, that's men and women of European descent, that's formerly enslaved people of African descent. This war has dramatic effects on the population of North America.
The pain of that forced relocation and its ongoing impact is still felt across the country today. For many Americans, the 250th anniversary is complicated. We as a country are at a crossroads. Deep political, economic, and social divides can make the country feel like it's still a battleground. What's clear, though, is the impact the American Revolution had on the world. More than 100 nations have issued a Declaration of Independence since 1776.
The American Revolution is this ongoing experiment in liberty, equality, and self-government that continues to this day, but only if we see that it continues into the future. As we continue to advocate for the creation of a better future for all people, not just here in the United States, but around the world.
You've been hearing the final episode of The Making of Us. I've really enjoyed exploring the ongoing American experiment together. Thank you so much for listening. Molly Ingram, WSHU News.
For the latest from around Long Island Sound, listen on the radio, online, with our free app, and of course, tune in right here to the After All Things podcast every weekday evening. I'm Sabrina Garone. No show tomorrow. Have a fantastic holiday weekend, and I'll speak to you on Monday.